Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for this very nice conference and for the invitation. Good, so I will talk about tensor networks that possess certain symmetries. It's just topological order in disguise, essentially. So as I will talk about tensor networks, I felt like it's quite different from the talks before, so it requires some introduction. When I'm talking about tensor networks, what I have in mind is a spin system. So spin sitting on a finite lattice, for example. Each spin is a finite dimensional vector space, and then the total Hilbert space is described by the tensor product of the individual Hilbert spaces. And then you're given a Hamiltonian that has some locality structure built in. For example, your spin sit on a lattice, then you can consider Hamiltonians where only the nearest neighbors interact. And the usual goal is to find the ground state of such Hamiltonians. Now, obviously, if you try to do this numerically, you face a big challenge because the dimension of this Hilbert space is exponentially with the system size. So if you have a system of consisting only like 100 particles, then you don't have any chance to solve exactly the Hamiltonian, simply because you cannot describe states in the Hilbert space. So obviously, there are methods around to overcome this problem. One of the possible methods is using variational ansatzes. So if you want to use a good variational ansatz to solve these kind of problems, what do you need for that? So first of all, you need a ansatz that describes states with only a few parameters, so such that you can store it on your computer. Then you also want a variational ansatz with which you can calculate. As there is a locality structure built in the Hamiltonian, and anyway in physics you're interested in calculating expectation values of local observables, what this means that you want to be able to calculate just expectation values of local observables. Finally, you expect that the variational ansatz approximates ground states of these kind of Hamiltonians well. And tensor networks are just such an ansatz. Good, so before introducing tensor networks, I will use the graphical notation that is widely used in this field. So I think it's fairly natural to think linear maps, depict them as some dots with some arrows attached to it. Incoming arrows mean that these are the incoming indices of your linear map, and the outgoing arrows are the outgoing indices of your map. So I think it's fairly natural to think of this picture as a linear map that maps the vector spaces V3 tensor V4 to V1 tensor V2 tensor V3. So when I'm talking about tensor networks, I won't think about linear maps anymore. I will instead think of this object as a tensor living in the tensor space, tensor product of all these spaces. When you think about how you do numerics, it's just that you store an array with 5 indices in your computer. Then there is one more piece of the puzzle to depict tensor networks, namely tensor contraction, which is just simply evaluating a linear map on a vector. So if you have two tensors, you can take their tensor product, just simply placing one next to the other. And if you find two indices where one corresponds to a vector in a given vector space and the other index corresponds to a linear functional on the same vector space, then you can just do this contraction. Pictorially, I will just connect these two lines. All right. Numerically, what you just do is you take these arrays that is in your stored on your computer and just contract the corresponding indices. Good. Okay, so given this graphical representation, I will define tensor networks the following way. So first of all, I will be given a graph with certain vertices and edges. Then I will place on each vertex of the graph a tensor, where the tensor will have one rank more than the degree of the vertex in the graph. And I will arrange the indices such that some of the indices point towards the edge, and there is one index pointing out, like that's not contained in the graph. I will refer to these indices that correspond to the edges in the graph as the virtual indices, whereas the extra index as physical index. So once you do that, you can then contract the indices corresponding to the same edge of the two tensors that sit on the two opposite endpoints of the edge. This will give you a state that lives in the tensor product of all these physical Hilbert spaces. So what is left after contraction is all these edges that I attached extra. So basically, what tensor network does is it builds a global state in a tensor product Hilbert space out of small local components. And because of this, these states you can represent on a computer because these tensors are assumed to be fairly small. Good. So let's see some examples for tensor networks. The most famous ones are matrix product states. In this case, you have a graph that is just a simple cycle. And what I will do, I will not do it anymore, I think. I will put arrows on this graph. And on each edge, I will put a vector space. That's going to be my virtual space. And then place tensors again to the individual vertices, as in the previous slide. These vertices are, so these tensors live in a threefold tensor product because this dot has three indices. So here, the incoming arrow was corresponds to V star, the outgoing arrow corresponds to V, and the extra index is the physical space. Good, so if you do this, you can also think of this rank three object as lives in the matrix space on V tensor the Hilbert space H. So when you create this object, so you put these tensors next to each other, what actually I think of is the tensor product of all these rank three tensors. If you write out, so if a single tensor you think you decompose as sum over AI, which is a matrix, times I, that is a basis vector in your Hilbert space, then when you write out this global state, what you get is this state. Okay, so these indices correspond to basis elements of the tensor product of this Hilbert spaces, whereas these matrices are just denoting these matrices here. Finally, to obtain the MPS, you contract all these tensors together. What it corresponds to is multiplying these matrices and then taking the trace. And this is the construction that I call matrix product states. Okay, it will be important later on in the talk to talk about matrix product operators. That is exactly the same construction as here, just instead of having a single Hilbert space attached to a given vertex, you have you attach matrices, and then you just parameterize it. You just take a basis, and then you expand it in the basis of your matrix space. Good. So far, the graphical notation wasn't very useful, but if you start doing bigger graphs, and especially in 2D, then you obtain you can, so if you consider a square lattice in two dimensions, then you can create a tensor network that looks like this. So you take a square lattice, you put on each vertex a rank 5 tensor, and then you contract according to the graph geometry. Now the graphical notation is extra useful because I will not write formula for this. It's fairly awful. Good. So as I said earlier, I primarily think of tensor networks as variational ansatzes for solving like Hamiltonian problems. So one important thing is to be sure that when you do a variational ansatz, it doesn't discard certain phases. So you want to be sure that your variational ansatz can capture all physics, and in particular that it can capture topologically ordered states. So what I will talk about is that how PEPs can describe topologically ordered phases. Again, it's important to understand that it's needed for being a good variational ansatz. So what people understood is that PEPs can describe string net models. So it's a work mostly done in Frank Fersterte's group. But apart from string net models that are renormalization fixed points, you can also do perturb away from these renormalization fixed points, and then can study phase transitions in tensor networks. So I think this is a good feature of tensor networks and a good motivation to use tensor networks. So it's been understood that when you describe these string net models, when you analyze how your tensors look like, your tensors happen to have certain symmetries. And it's well understood that the original of topological properties is exactly the presence of these symmetries. So what I will talk about from now on is how these symmetries of the tensor network look like. So these symmetries are purely acting on the virtual levels. Okay, so the degrees of freedom that get contracted in the tensor network construction. And they are sort of size independent. More precisely, they are described by matrix product operators. So for example, if you take the toric code, it is you can work out that you can describe it with PEPs. It's fairly easy. And what you will get is that the PEPs tensor has these symmetries that if you act with the X matrix on each of the virtual bonds, then the tensor remains invariant. So a fairly useful way to think about these symmetries is just simply rearrange the axes, put two axes on the other side. And then what the way it generalizes to other kind of topological order is that instead of having the tensor product of local operators here, you will have a matrix product operator that acts simultaneously on certain edges of the tensor. And then the symmetry looks like you act on certain indices, and then you can pull through this string to the other side of the tensor. I will refer to this equation often as pulling through equation. So once you have a symmetry that looks like this, that you have a matrix product operator that you can pull through your MPS PEPS tensor, it's actually size independent. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that if you take your PEPs on a larger patch, this patch has the same symmetry with the same matrix product operator. Why is that? Simply because if you start looking at this symmetry, this tensor network here in the upper left corner, you can use this equation and pull this string through the first tensor. Then you can take a look, for example, at this tensor. You can use this equation again. You can pull the string through once more, and so on, until you pull through the string completely on the other side. So what is important is that indeed these symmetries are size independent. So in an, even in an extensive system, you find symmetry. So why is this symmetry important, or how does it lead to topological properties? It's simply the fact that a local Hamiltonian does not detect this symmetry operator. Why is that? Because a local Hamiltonian just checks that locally this state looks like, so if you insert here a symmetry operator, you can create another state, and the Hamiltonian just simply checks that the, your state looks locally like your peps. If you create then a state with the symmetry string inside it, then a Hamiltonian operator here on this plaquette does not see the string at all. So the only way where the Hamiltonian can differentiate between your this state and the original ground state that you started with is on plaquettes that go through your string. But your strings are such that you can move it around in the lattice. So you can move out from this region where your Hamiltonian acts. And so your Hamiltonian really cannot differentiate between this state and the state without this symmetry operator inserted in it. So this phenomena leads to topological ground state degeneracy, as it's well known for the toric code. In the toric code, these strings actually become physical. So probably you know it. All right. So once you have such symmetries, you can also understand pictorially how excitations look like. If you start, if you put a string in your system and you end somehow your system at one plaquette and another endpoint in another plaquette, what you will see is that this state that you create with this extra string inserted, the Hamiltonian does not see this string at all, again, because of the same reasoning that this string can move out from this region where the Hamiltonian act, except for the two endpoints. So no matter what you do here, wherever you move the string, you cannot change the fact that it ends in these two plaquettes. And because of that, you have two excitations at these two endpoints of the string. Good. So I hope I convinced you more or less that topological properties are due to the fact that you have symmetries in your PEPS tensor. So where do these symmetries come from? So in the toric code, you have two different matrix product operators. You have the identity and the all x string. Whereas in G-injective PEPS, so Kitaev models that describe the quantum double of a group, you have G different NPOs. They are labeled by group elements, and they are simply just tensor products of the group elements. In general, if you want to describe string net models, these NPOs, they arise from, they describe simple objects of a fusion category. Good. So once you have these NPOs, it's noteworthy to say that a pulling through equation like this corresponds to symmetrizing your MPS tensor. So it really, so once you have a pulling through equation, it's the same as symmetrizing your MPO with your PEPS tensor with a closed MPO. And if you do that, you can collect all MPOs together and collect all MPOs that act trivially on your PEPS tensor, and they form an algebra. So for example, if you find two MPOs, one labeled by A, the other labeled by B, that has this property, then their linear combination is also symmetric. And their product is also obviously a symmetric. So they very naturally form an algebra. So if I collect just all periodic boundary MPOs here. You get algebra of all the symmetries of your Lebesgue tensor. So I will think of creating an MPO, a larger bond dimensional MPO of this individual independent MPO. So in the previous slide, you see that you have different MPOs labeled by, for example, group elements. Instead of that, when I think of sums of these operators, I can just stack the MPOs together, create a larger bond dimensional MPO, and I will think of all the operators inside this algebra as a large MPO with some boundary condition. And this boundary condition has a very special structure. It's just compatible with the stacking of the MPOs. So again, how does this algebra look like? If your symmetries arise from a group, then your MPOs just form, again, a product. I mean, they multiply according to the group. If your MPOs arise from fusion categories, so you want to describe string nets that has certain fusion category symmetries, then these MPOs form a fusion ring. So when you multiply the two of them, then they split according to the fusion rules. Yes?
So we have a comment from Sharon Brownline. The tensor network describing a topological order may not have the described symmetry. Only the fixed point ideal tensor network has the symmetry. Thus, topological order may not have any symmetry, but it has emergent symmetry.
Okay, yes. So I thought that these symmetries are actually, so when you these symmetries are stable under, no, so how to say it? So when you perturb away from, so you add the perturbation to your Lebesgue tensor that is symmetric, and the perturbation breaks the symmetry, then it also destroys your topological order usually.
But I think the question is more like, take the ground state of like the Torr code Hamiltonian, right? The Torr code is a zero correlation like exponent, which clearly has a symmetry.
Yes.
Now add a little bit of like a transverse field, right? So that you have like this term that's going to kind of, in perturbation theory, pair create these defects.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ground state wave function still have this symmetry? That's sort of the
okay.
So the intuition is like you can't pull the string across when you have, say, like you can't pull the string through your vertex if you have an E particle sitting at the vertex. But this perturbation like adds, if you will, virtual pairs of these E particles, and therefore the symmetry is not kind of microscopically a symmetry. Although, as Shagan points out, you know, kind of these pairs are confined, and therefore, if you coarse grained it, you would get to this fixed point wave function. The fixed point of the RG flow, and that would have this symmetry.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, yeah, yeah, okay, yes. Yes, I agree. All right. Good, so yeah, then it's nice to think of these symmetries and emergent symmetries, actually. All right, so so what's important, again, is that, like at least in an emergent sense, your Lebesgue tensors will have these symmetries. And it turns out that to describe at least randomization fixed points, you can think of your Lebesgue tensors as only a special element from your MPO algebra. So you can think of this Lebesgue tensor as having four different physical indices instead of like grouping them together. And then once you know the MPOs, you can construct a PEPS that has the given topological order. All right, so what I'm going to explain now is that while people usually think of these MPOs as objects arising from a fusion category, I usually think of them as representations of weak Hopf algebras. These two things are completely equivalent. It's just you have to write it out explicitly how it looks like. So the way I think of, the nice way to think of this equivalence is that instead of considering matrix product operators that are translation invariant, you can also consider matrix product operators that you close with a boundary condition. And then these matrix product operators are still be symmetries of your PEPS tensor. Okay, this you have to take with a grain of salt. This equation is only true for Hopf algebras. For weak Hopf algebras, it's not exactly how it looks like. Yes?
Is this boundary condition telling me like, oh, there might be an excitation on the vertex? Or what is that B dot telling me?
No, it's so simply I'm trying to collect. So what I'm trying to say is that your PEPS tensors have more symmetries than just the translation invariant MPOs.
Mm-hmm. But in the top picture, you've got this little. So before I thought it was just I take the red ring and I can kind of mush it through the vertex and collapse it. Mm-hmm. But now what is B in there? Is that like an insertion of some kind of other line operator or like what is it?
So intuitively, what you can think of here is that you take these. So you remember that you have this pulling through symmetry, right? So you can pull this string on the other side of the PEPS tensor, and then you get a bubble, and that bubble will pop essentially. Okay, for Hopf algebras, it really pops even with non-trivial boundary condition. Okay, so so what I do is I take my MPO symmetries. Right, and then I close the boundary of the MPO with a certain matrix instead of the identity.
But can I think of that as some kind of like twist in the symmetry or something like that? Or?
Sort of. Okay. Yes. It's, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, what I'm trying to tell that you have more symmetries than just the parallel boundary condition one. And it turns out that the way you define these MPO symmetries, even if you put an arbitrary boundary condition here, these MPOs will still multiply together. So they still form an algebra. So what you can do is collect all these symmetries together, and they also form another algebra, right? So it's a bigger algebra than the algebra of your periodic boundary condition MPOs. And this is the thing that is going to be a weak Hopf algebra. So this is how you get back from your fusion category, a weak Hopf algebra, of which the representation category is the fusion category you started with. All right, so if you have injective tensors, then you can essentially compress these MPOs together to a single tensor. And then you can think of your algebra as these very short MPOs. And then one important point of a weak Hopf algebra that it has a co-product that is a map that goes from the algebra to A tensor A. And this co-product actually corresponds to growing your MPO. Okay. So if your algebra element is described by this very short MPO, then the co-product is then described by the MPO on two sides. So as I said, in a weak Hopf algebra, you have the algebra structure, you have this coproduct, and then you have some additional properties that these MPOs satisfy. And that forms a weak Hopf algebra. So roughly speaking, this is how you can think of the transition from fusion categories to weak Hopf algebras. And again, all what we do is that fusion categories are just representations of weak Hopf algebras. So what we do is like we just create a weak Hopf algebra of which the representations are a given fusion category you started with. All right, so I would like to convince now you that this algebraic formulation is actually useful. At least we use it. We use it in several different projects. For example, can understand transfer operators of the topologically ordered PEPSes. We can understand renormalization fixed point MPDOs, matrix product density operators. So once you understand this algebraically, you can try to classify phases of renormalization fixed point matrix product density operators that should sort of reflect some properties of phases in 2D. And what we really use in this classification project is the algebraic description of matrix product density operators. Finally, you can use this algebraic description to characterize symmetries in topologically ordered PEPs. It's still in preparation, this project. And I hope to arrive at defining some other possibly interesting states that has some kind of topological properties, so that has the symmetries that are extensive and you can pull through the whole system, but they are not really topological in the usual sense. All right, so I told you roughly how to think of VCOPF algebras, like the relation between VCOPF algebras and matrix product operators. If you know how you construct the tensor network description of string net models, that's very nice. But if you don't, I can also tell you how to form matrix product operators starting from VCOPF algebra. More precisely, from an algebra that has a coproduct as well. So basically, I will just use the bi-algebra structure. So I consider an algebra with a coproduct that is a map that goes from A to A tensor A, and that is associative, and that is compatible with the product. And out of this structure, I will create a representation that looks like a matrix product operator. And this matrix product operator is going to be exactly the same MPO that I told you before. So for that, notice that if A star is the set of linear functionals on A, then A star also forms an algebra. So this algebraic structure is self-dual. You can define the product on A star by the usual convolutional product. And then it's easy to check that it's an associative product just because of the associativity of the coproduct.
Sir, did you say self-dual?
Yes. Meaning that when you take the linear functionals, so what I exactly mean that if you have a structure that is an algebra with a unit and a co-algebra with a co-unit, and then you take the set of linear functionals over such an object, okay, I always assume finite dimension, then this structure has both a product and it has a co-product as well.
Yeah, but it can be a different algebra.
Ah, sorry, yeah, different algebra, but mm-hmm. Same algebraic structure. Indeed, sorry, yeah. Right. Okay, so as I said, you can check that the convolutional product is indeed a product. And then A star is an algebra. Okay, so now I can give you exactly how to construct a matrix product operator out of such an algebraic object. So what we do is we fix a representation of both A star and the representation of the algebra A. Pictorially, I will just write the representation will be of A star will be the horizontal lines and representations of the algebra will be the vertical lines. So if the representation psi is injective or faithful, then you can always find a matrix M of X such that the linear functional f applied on x is the trace of mx times psi f. Okay, it's just injectivity of the representation of psi. Graphically, what you write is you write the representation psi ff, you multiply by the matrix sum of x, and then you trace out. Now what you can do is you take a basis of A, let's call it xi, and you take the dual basis of this basis on A star, let's call the basis elements fi, and then we can set the NPO tensor to be simply the identity. So it's sum over I, the representation of the dual basis element fi tensor, the representation of the matrix element xi. Then by construction, because of this equality here, phi of x is this very short MPS. Why is that? It's just simply I use that this is the identity, and trace of m of x f is evaluating to f of x. And then when you put it here, you just get back algebra element x. OK, so what happens when you grow the MPO? This is going to be going to describe you exactly the coproduct. Why is that? Well, let's just write in the definition of the MPO tensor. You can just put in the definition that it's sum over fi tensor xi on the first, and fj tensor xj, should be j, on the second tensor. And then you can recognize that here what we are doing is tracing m of y with the product of fi times fj. And this gets multiplied by phi xi tensor phi xj. So decoding again that this is the convolutional product, you get that this is fi tensor fj acting on delta y. And now we use again that sum over xi tensor fi is the identity. So this evaluates to the representation of delta y. So we got an algebra, a representation where growing the MPO corresponds to taking the coproduct of a matrix element, algebra element. So one can convince themselves similarly that if you take a long, long MPO with n particles, it's just taking the n minus first coproduct of the algebra element, there should be a minus one here, and represented with the corresponding representation. OK, so if it's a bit confusing, let's work out what happens in the group algebra case. In the group algebra case, you have a nice basis. You have the group elements. Then the dual basis is simply I denote with delta g. Delta g of h is 1 if g equals h and 0 otherwise. So the convolutional product then in CG is g times h is delta g if g equals h and 0 otherwise. And then you can convince yourself that this algebra is abelian, and so all the reps are 1D. And in fact, the left regular representation looks like G maps to GG, to a one-dimensional projector. And then this MPO tensor looks the following way. It looks like you have on the vertical line, you have the representation of your group element. And on the virtual line, you have a rank one projector. So when you contract this MPO, what you will get is exactly the tensor product of the group elements times that are mixed according to x. Yeah. All right. So now there are two different ways for us to think about MPOs. So you can think of as these MTOs as arising from theorem categories, or as I prefer, you can think of as VCOP algebra representations. So it's also nice to rewrite the whole PEPS formalism to incorporate this, the fact that I think of these MPOs as a representation of VCOP algebras, and to understand how what this symmetry actually means in the VCOP algebra language. Okay, so this we will do through an example of G-injective PEPS. So G-injective PEPS, the PEPS tensors look the following way. So after you take the run normalization fixed point, it's just a tensor product of G tensor G tensor G minus one G minus one. So you can think of it as a matrix product operator going around these four edges. But there is a little complication here that I wrote G minus one here. Why is that? It's simply because the representation of G minus one is the transpose of the dual representation of G. So what happens here is actually this is an MPO that represents G tensor G tensor G tensor G. Just here on this representation, you put the dual representation to this one, and then you have to transpose this representation. And that's why you get phi G minus one. Okay, so once your tensor looks like this, it's very easy to convince yourself that this tensor has a pulling through equation. So if you pull through a string of group elements H, that you can pull it through like this. It simply corresponds to the equation that if you take HG tensor G minus one and sum over G, it's the same as G tensor G minus one times H. Okay, so then you can create again a PEPS out of these MPO tensors. Like your PEPS tensor will be this MPO, and then the whole tensor network looks like something like this. Exactly because of this pulling through equation, then this tensor network has again a global symmetry that if you put a string around it, then you can pull it through. And it's it's interesting to note that if you regroup the degrees of freedom, so you will start to, if you start to think of these two degrees of freedom together as particle instead of these four degrees of freedom as particles, then it exactly gives you a ground state of the Kitaev model. So it's a sort of fun thing. Yes?
Yeah, maybe it's about that last point, but somehow, like, if I could think about, you know, kind of a generalization of the Torah code on the square lattice, and then I would have expected that, so here you have, you know, a G, G, G inverse, G inverse, mm-hmm. and like, it kind of looks like those are somehow your virtual, like, variational states, and I would have thought that I could have had, you know, something like a any four things that multiply to the identity. But maybe I've... Or is that because this is in the virtual index space? That's what you're saying. Like, what are the, you know, where are the physical degrees of freedom? What do they look like in this variational state?
So when I think of as, okay, so there are two different things that you can do.
Yeah.
When I think of them as G-injective PEPs, I like to think of these two being these four being one physical index.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then this is what describes the run normalization fixed point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can perturb away by putting like an extra tensor here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in the run normalization fixed point, you can also think of, instead of these four being one physical degree of freedom, being this one being a physical degree of freedom. And then, okay, what happens is that, this degree of freedom then is a representation of your group, right? And then you have two actions. You can act with the G inverse from the left, it should be right, and G from the left. And that's exactly one ingredient to describe the KitAI model, right? That you have these left and right actions simultaneously from the two sides of the degree of freedom. Right,
yeah, so, I guess, so when you say you're getting to the KitAI quantum level model, like, you know, so that has degrees of freedom on the edges of the lattice. So where is that lattice with respect to your...
So usually I think you would draw the lattice like this.
Okay.
So the dual lattice.
And then the physical degrees of freedom would...
Are sitting on these edges.
Right? And how do you get them from the white and black dot? How are they related?
So this is one physical degree of freedom.
So it's like the product of those two.
Yes.
The physical
degree. And if this is the... Okay, so here if you use the left regular representation, then whenever you take the product of these matrices, you're still in the left regular representation, right? And then you can just compress back to the group algebra, right? And that is actually the KitAI model. So,
okay.
But you have to do is like you still have to recompress this to the group algebra.
Okay.
All right, so I want to generalize this G-injective case to more general scenarios. So it's important to understand what is the important algebraic structure. So first of all, these MPOs that we used here arise from the projector to the trivial EREP. So one important object in our algebra is the projector to the trivial EREP. And the important property is that this delta, so the coproduct of the projector of the trivial EREP has this pulling through property that if you apply, so if you take the coproduct and take the multiplication with a group element acting on the second half, it's the same as multiplying with the inverse of the group element on the first half of your coproduct. Another important ingredient that we used is that if we have a representation on a vector space V, then when you take the transpose and compose with the antipode being the inverse in the group algebra, you get again a representation on the dual space that is the dual representation. Okay, so when you think through, this is exactly the structure that you have to use for describing symmetries of with semi-simple Hopf algebras. So the important algebraic structure is that you have a bi-algebra, okay, and there is the Haar integral that has the following properties. It's symmetric, so if I take the coproduct of the Haar integral and I take the opposite coproduct, then it's the same element. This will correspond to the fact that the MPO is translation invariant. Then the Haar integral has this pulling through property. This equation is actually equivalent to the definition of the left integral. And it's also going to be important that the antipode is co-commutative. So when you compose the antipode with the coproduct is the same as applying the antipode on both components and swapping the arguments. Okay, as I said, this equation will correspond to the fact that the Haar integral is translation invariant. So in general, okay, so for the group elements, this was naturally translation invariant. When you generalize your setting to Hopf algebras, what you will get is still that the Haar integral is translation invariant. And again, this equation, the second equation, is just the pulling through equation that gives you the symmetries of your tensor network. And finally, this mysterious equation will pop up in some compatibility equations of on plaquettes. So when you want to check that the plaquette is also symmetric and not only just pulling through from the left corner to the lower right corner, then you will have to use at some point that this equation holds. So given such a structure, then a Hopf-injective PEPS, at least in the renormalization fixed point, looks something like this. So you put the Haar integral on each of these four particles, and then you construct your tensor network like this. And again, the same thing holds as in the G-injective PEPS. If you regroup your degrees of freedom, so you start thinking of these as your degrees of freedom, and then recompress it back to your Hopf algebra, then this is exactly the ground state of the Kitaev model. And finally, what I like to think of is the Weckhoff algebra case. The important algebraic structure in a Weckhoff algebra, in a semi-simple Weckhoff algebra, is the following, that it's a bialgebra, and then there is an element that is not the Haar integral anymore, but it's the regular element. Okay, so it's another element that is translation invariant. And it has a pulling through property, but this pulling through property is not anymore with the antipode, but with some other operation. And then this operation, when you take the coproduct, then it behaves nicely under the coproduct, namely it's the same as taking the opposite coproduct twice and then applying in the middle some group-like element. Okay, this last line just wants to say that G is group-like. Again, in this structure, this equation corresponds to the fact that your MPOs that you start from which you construct your MPS PEPS tensor is translation invariant. This equation will correspond to the pulling through equation. And again, note that you have two different tensors here, the black and the white ones. The white ones will use a sort of a dual representation to this representation here. But the dual representation will not be defined through the antipode, but through this operation that, by the way, from this equation and the fact that lambda is translation invariant is guaranteed to stack to identity. Good. And then finally, this mysterious equation here is, again, the same as for Hopf algebras. When you want to check that a placket itself is symmetric and you don't only want to check that you can pull through a string from the upper left corner to the lower right corner, but like also other kind of symmetries, then you will need to use this equation. And finally, such an algebraic structure you can also find in not Weckhoff algebras, but also in non-semisimple Hopf algebras if they satisfy certain condition, namely that the antipode squares to an inner automorphism where the inner automorphism is a group-like element. And such an example is, for instance, the Tuft Hopf algebras. And in the Tuft Hopf algebras, you can find exactly the same structure. Yes. And once you have such a structure, you can construct a PEPS. How do you construct the PEPS? You take your MPOs that describe the regular element of your Weckhoff algebra, so this lambda. Then you put this on the vertices of your graph. And then on each placket, you have to insert an extra element here that is this group-like element described here. Okay, so this is why I say that this group-like element is important for plaquettes. If you think about three-line notations in string net models, then this green line corresponds exactly to insert a quantum dimension whenever you have a closed loop in your tensor network. Okay, so this green line corresponds takes care of one quantum dimension, the blue dot takes care of the other quantum dimension. And so what is important here is that you, once you create a tensor network like this, you will have a global symmetry. And again, you can do the same thing. You can regroup, compress back to your weak hop algebra, and then hopefully it corresponds to ground state of the Kitaev model.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Do you have a favorite example of a weak hop algebra that you've used to test this machinery on? And if so, like what dimension is it?
So I think a canonical example is creating one of the weak hop algebras that gives you the Fibonacci anions. That's a nine-dimensional one.
Yes.
Yes. I think that's the smallest that is non-trivial. Like, okay, I mean, you can also take the trivial representation of that, that is just like two-dimensional. So it's like, I mean, when you write matrices, it's four dimensions. But that's a bit too trivial, maybe. All right, so as I told you, you can create this tensor network not only for weak hop algebras, but for certain non-semisimple hop algebras, so for tough hop algebras. And then the states that you get are sort of mysterious. But what do we know so far is that the definition makes sense, at least if you don't close the boundary conditions, then you don't have any problem. If you put your state on a torus, you can still define the PEPs. But funnily, if you try to create the same PEPs on a sphere, well, the definition leads to the zero state. But we also know that, so to each PEPs, you can create a so-called parent Hamiltonian, of which the ground state is the PEPs, or like one of the ground states is the PEPs. And when you create it for this particular PEPs defined from a tough top algebra, then the ground space of the parent Hamiltonian is the expected one, at least not on a, at least when you, once you don't close the boundaries. What else do we know? It has non-zero correlation length. Okay, but we don't know much more about it. So if you've ever run into such a model, please let me know. I'm super interested in it. Probably there is some connection to non-semisimple TQFTs, or it's an instance of non-semisimple string nets. So if you know anything about it, please let me know. Okay, and with this, I would like to conclude. So basically what I was talking about is that tensor networks can describe topological order, and the way people think about this topological order in tensor networks is that you have matrix product operator symmetries. So you have symmetries that act purely on the virtual level of your tensors and that are extensive. Usually these MPOs you construct from fusion categories. And what I told you about is an alternative formulation that is completely equivalent in principle, is that you can think of these weak hop these MPOs and as representations of weak hop algebras. And finally, this leads to a funny model that I still want to understand better. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Could you quickly run through the explanation how you construct this weak hop algebra again, where you had this very small MPO and then coproduct was making it slightly bigger?
So from the MPO to the weak hop algebra, right?
Yes. So the so the vector space, for example, what does it?
Okay, so what happens here is that you have a bunch of MPOs that I grouped together, right, to a big MPO. Mm-hmm. Then you close it with arbitrary boundary condition.
Yeah, and the green dot, is it some specific tensor that you...
Yes, it's a very specific tensor.
How that, do I get it? Is it something that...
Well, it's the magic that I don't understand how people get these... these tensors from fusion categories or bimodule categories. But these tensors are like, I mean, they are block diagonal, right? Because that's how I constructed them, just stacking them together. Each of them is injective, meaning that if I put here a boundary condition for each of them individually, then these states are going to be linearly independent. Now the problem is that, so when you consider the different sectors, there might be some overlap, but nevertheless, what you can do in that case is you just rename the, like you group these tensors together to some one big tensor, then they become also linearly independent because these are completely different injective MPS tensors. So if I consider such a thing, whenever I insert different Bs here, I get different vectors here. And this is how I define my algebra.
Can I just check the this last kind of class of things? So you said there's things that you can do when you with the Weakhoff algebra that, if I understood correctly, are the, you know, they're not string nets because they're not ground states of a sort of commutative projector Hamiltonian.
The for the semisimple non-semisimple yes.
Semisimple
Hopf. It's a Hopf algebra, right? It's just non-semisimple.
Okay. And so in particular, they like basically these are somehow states that have this symmetry that is associated with something like topological order, but they're not somehow they're not zero correlation length.
They are not zero. Yeah.
But they're still exponential correlations, or?
I don't know that. I think it's algebraic.
So then would you think that
probably
the Hamiltonian is
Gapless? I don't know. So what we started to do is take one of the examples and then take the transfer matrix and then see whether it's chiral or not. Well, for the very smallest example, the tensor is real, so it's not chiral for sure. We haven't done the numerics yet for a larger example. So when you create the nine-dimensional Tuftopf algebra, it's not real anymore. So it might be chiral, and we sort of hope that it's chiral, but it's nine-dimensional, so numerics is a bit hard.
But is it possible that it's some kind of critical point or something?
Okay. Yes. That's okay. I don't know. I was hoping that someone knows something like this. Yes?
So fusion category, so every fusion category is representation of Weakhoff algebra. So in the non-semisimple model, you get, could it be that if you take the level one string net one, but instead of using a fusion category, get rid of the semisimple condition, consider a model in those categories, but non-semisimple, do you get the same model?
Yes, I mean, I don't, okay, so if you get, I mean, if these categories are representations of non-semisimple Weakhoff algebras, then all that you need is pivotality, I think, and then you can define these models. So you need a pivotal tensor category, maybe? Yes, yeah. And then probably it works.
Yes? So have you considered this holographic tensor networks, where there could be some fusion carrier asymmetry for the boundary or the tensor network, but in the bulk, it must be somehow gauged. Like for the group like case, there seems to be some work where there's a way of gauging the symmetries, group symmetry acting on the tensor network. So making sure that the symmetry is gauged in the bulk in the holographic case.
No, sorry. We haven't considered. Yes?
You gave this construction of some tensor network state, right? I'm wondering, can you construct any state that's not in the same phase as any string net model? Or do they always live in some one of those phases?
So depends what you mean exactly. So if you for example, interested in this because of studying phase transition, that what you can do is like, again, you take a renormalization fixed point and then not consider the renormalization fixed point, but put here another tensor. And that tensor can be arbitrarily ugly. So for example, it can just be a projector to like a rank one projector. And then no matter what the symmetries of this object are, what you get is a product state. And then you can interpolate between these two tensors where you put the identity here versus where you put the rank one projector. And that's how people study phase transitions, I think.
Oh, I guess I was not worried about the phase transitions, but more like if I look at the classification of gap phases, am I getting something that's not in the string next space?
No, you don't. As long as you don't put non-semi-simple stuff.
Sorry,
it's
are you
exactly
asking string next.
I guess, yeah.
Is that part of the question? Like, does this symmetry mean that you are, if you do the fusion category symmetry, does it force you to be generating some topological order that admits a gap boundary to the vector?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Is that?
Because, I mean, these are just the string net models, essentially.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Unless you put some non-semi-simple stuff there. Yes.
Sorry, so would we need the non-semi-simple stuff? Is Hamiltonian still functioning?
So what you can do is, I'm not doing the Kitaev Hamiltonian. You can do a Kitaev like Hamiltonian that's going to be non-Hermitian but commuting, but that's, I wouldn't call it Hamiltonian because it's non-Hermitian. So instead, what you can do is, once you have a tensor network state, there is a standard way to construct a Hamiltonian of which the tensor network state is the ground state. And then I can just take that Hamiltonian just check that, I mean, then still the tensor network state is the ground state by definition. And you can check that the ground space itself is not super bad. So it's exactly the ground space that you expect. Of course, this Hamiltonian will not be commuting anymore. So also for the string net models, you can create that Hamiltonian. And even in the string net models case, it's not going to be commuting.
We save all further questions for another time and thank Andre for the talk.